The so-called Porngate scandal involving offensive emails exchanged among Pennsylvania state officials is not dying down anytime soon. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Embattled Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane announced today that she's appointed a special prosecutor to investigate the tens of thousands of emails and prosecute any crimes that may have occurred. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies was there.
Hundreds of emails have already emerged in the scandal, tainting the reputations of many and ending the public careers of some. Kathleen Kane has plenty of legal problems herself, including criminal charges she leaked grand jury material. She's maintained they were corruptly manufactured by men determined to prevent her from exposing their pornographic email traffic. In announcing an expanded investigation, Kane certainly didn't back off the rhetoric.
No woman should go to work and be subjected to consistent treatment of disgusting indignity by women haters because they were born with one less body part, which the last I heard does not contain any extra brain cells.
The man Kane tapped to investigate the emails is former Maryland Attorney General Douglas Gansler. He says he and his team, four people from his Maryland law firm, are the right ones to look into the mess because they have no ties to Pennsylvania and no preconceptions.
I've not seen one email from this case, and that's the point. We are independent. We will remain independent. We will not be having contact with the general. We will have a contact in her office to make sure that we can get the materials that we need. But we will go with the facts wherever they will lead us.
There have been calls for a comprehensive investigation of the emails lately, some from legal authorities who say they show an inappropriately close relationship among some prosecutors and judges. Gansler's written charge from Kane includes looking into a lack of impartiality or independence among actors in the legal system. Gansler says he's confident the investigation will cost less than $2 million. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Penn State University continues to pay millions of dollars to victims in the Jerry Sandusky child sexual abuse scandal. Who's footing the bill of the high-priced settlements? As WHYY's Bobby Allen notes, that question will soon be debated in a Philadelphia courtroom.
The total payout amounts of victims of the former assistant football coach's abuse is now approaching $100 million. But Penn State's insurance company says it's the school's problem and refuses to pay. It says, quote, abuse and molestation is excluded from Penn State's coverage.
When we have insurance coverage litigation, it's often in situations where the stakes are big.
That's Temple Law professor Mark Roddard, who studies insurance disputes. He says policies are usually written generically. It takes lawsuits to really start defining what it all means. While Penn State fights this in court, the school says it's paid $92.8 million to settle 32 claims from an emergency fund. The fund is complicated, but it's essentially money generated from loan interest on loans the school gave itself. Penn State says it's not using tuition, taxpayer, or donor money for the payments. The school's budget is around $4 billion a year, but it said in court filings that settling additional claims without the insurance company's help will put it in an untenable position.
Both parties would rather meet in the middle. You know, Penn State would much prefer to get $40 million than to be stuck with all $90 million to cover, and the insurance company would much rather pay $40 million than have to pay all $90 million, and you don't know how it's going to come out when it gets to, say, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
A trial date is set for March, but both sides could settle well before then. Victim claims, meanwhile, keep piling up while the 71-year-old Sandusky serves the rest of his life in prison. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Recent protests at Princeton University were intended in part to consider former Princeton and U.S. President Woodrow Wilson in a new light. Joining me to shed light on the controversy on this episode of That's History is Jonathan Zimmerman, historian at New York University. Jonathan, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Good to be here as always.
Jonathan, Princeton President Christopher Eisgruber recently said that Wilson's record on race is disturbing, and for him, the intent going forward is to make Princeton a more welcoming and supportive community for all its members. Now, many of the protesters and those who are sympathetic want Wilson's name scrubbed from many of the buildings and sites on campus. Where does that thoughtful discussion start?
Well, the president is right. I mean, Wilson's record on race is deeply troubling. I mean, we're talking about a guy who, when he became president, immediately segregated the federal workforce and possibly even worse than that, demoted African Americans who had made their way through the civil service.
And prior to that, Wilson was apparently the last Ivy League president to maintain a policy of Jim Crow exclusion of both students and faculty.
That's true, too. I think it's good we're having this conversation, which is what the president ordered. But I am troubled by the idea of trying to scrub the guy's name from buildings or from the record, precisely because I think that if we did that, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We do need to reckon with what Wilson meant for our country, especially regarding race. But there are other sides of him, too, that I think are extremely complicated that we need to know about as well.
For example?
Well, it starts with the fact that Wilson was one of the architects of this thing called progressivism. The progressive idea was we needed a much stronger state in order to ameliorate all the negative effects of the Industrial Revolution. So we needed a strong government to regulate mines so people didn't die in them, and to regulate railroads for the same reason, to regulate food and drugs and meat. And we also needed a strong government in order to regulate big corporations. And Wilson himself was an enormously important figure in that.
But again, blacks and minorities were at best tangential beneficiaries of these policies.
At that time, there's no question about it. The civil service is a good example of that. The civil service itself was a progressive reform, the idea of having tests and other merit-based systems in order to select and promote federal employees. But of course, because of Wilson's racism, he didn't abide by the merit system. And that's a good example of the way that race colored all of progressivism. But progressivism also helped build a state, build the federal government, which, especially in later eras, was, and I would argue continues to be, an important protector of the rights of Americans, including minority Americans. And that's what makes Wilson's legacy so hard to grapple with.
How does one come to a consensus and move forward?
I'm not sure we can come to a consensus. I think, again, back to the metaphor that the current president of Princeton uses, what we need is a conversation. And my concern is twofold. A, I want that conversation to be about all of Wilson's legacy, including his state building, which has been such an important part of the progressive legacy. You think about health care. You think about worker safety. All the things we argue about today in many ways are themselves legacies of the progressive era, and I want that to be part of the conversation. And frankly, as a historian, I'm also troubled by the idea that we would eliminate Wilson from a conversation by, say, taking his name away from things. I feel the same way about statues of Confederate leaders in the South. If you take away these monuments, if you take away these buildings, we won't actually engage in the kind of dialogue that I hope we engage in about Wilson at Princeton. We'll just stop talking.
Perhaps equal to allowing Pete Rose or Barry Bonds into the Hall of Fame with an asterisk noting their transgressions, could there be a possible solution maintaining Wilson's presence, but noting on whatever monuments or plaques some of the more egregious aspects of his tenure?
Absolutely. And I would say that's what we're doing now rhetorically as we're talking about those asterisks. I think the Princeton students are correct when they say that the racial and the racist asterisk has been underplayed in the way that we have thought about and discussed Woodrow Wilson. And we need to include that asterisk in the discussion.
Let's asterisk this conversation. We'll pick it up again next time. Jonathan Zimmerman, thanks again for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is a historian at New York University. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Turning to this evening's headlines, the Pennsylvania House of Representatives approves a bill moving a program providing health insurance for more than 150,000 children into a new department. Today's vote on the Children's Health Insurance Program came without debate. Proponents said the transfer of responsibility from the insurance department to the Department of Human Services makes Pennsylvania's program match the other 49 states. Pennsylvania's Republican Party will feature billionaire, real estate mogul, and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump as the guest at a New York City fundraiser. Pennsylvania GOP Chair Rob Gleason says Trump's doing well in polling and that the party's donors would like to hear from him at the $1,000 a head Commonwealth Club luncheon December 11th. Gleason notes that Trump's appearance is not an endorsement from the state party. 54 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 616. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Here's your chance to help us create top-notch radio programming suited to the needs of our audience and region. Participate by taking our survey at whyy.org/survey. Showers continuing this evening, overnight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low 48 degrees, Wednesday's high 58. Sunshine returns Thursday, but cooler, high around 50. Still ahead.
She told me there was a big program where they can get books inside the doctor's office, and I'm like, books? They don't need little kids.
A local doctor's office provides books for those most at risk of falling behind academically, though they're not even able to read yet. NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Classics for the Holidays with Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Music from Bizet's Seductive Carmen and Stravinsky's Shimmering the Firebird. Also, Hilary Hahn plays Vuitton's Fourth Violin Concerto. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, The Firebird and Carmen with Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Support for WHYY comes from T-Mobile with a 4G LTE network designed for business. Learn more at T-Mobile.com/at work. That's T-Mobile.com/at work.
Support the programs you love and depend on this season. Plus, for every donation we receive through Sunday, December 13th, we'll donate a meal to someone in need. Visit WHYY.org to make your gift today.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Many parents don't read enough to their children, and research shows that literacy gaps emerge in kids as young as 18 months. WHYY's Sarah Hoover reports on what some doctors are doing to keep infants and toddlers from falling behind.
Dr. Elena Huang examined 17-month-old Keith Patrick at the Karabatz Pediatric Care Center in West Philadelphia. Like any kid 6 months to 5 years old, he gets a new book at every checkup.
So you remember we've given him books before, and now we try to pick one that might be some of the things that he's doing, like learning his body parts. So this one says, where's your nose? What does your nose do? And where's your mouth?
That's because this clinic is part of Reach Out and Read, a national nonprofit that partners with medical providers to give free books at doctor's visits. Dr. Trudy Hecker, pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, or CHOP, is the medical director for Reach Out and Read Greater Philadelphia.
Those first 1,000 days are the most important for brain development. And to stimulate language, you want to be able to be talking, singing, reading to your baby.
Reach Out and Read has 47 sites in southeastern Pennsylvania that serve more than 40,000 children annually. For sites to qualify for the program, 35% of the kids they serve must come from low-income families, but doctors hand out books to all kids coming in for checkups.
For many of our families, they don't think to have books at that very young age. So it's very unusual for some of our families to have books in the home and to have the ability to think about reading early.
Hecker founded the Philadelphia program almost 20 years ago. One of the first families she worked with was Tamia Howard, who in 1996 was pregnant with twin daughters.
I was high risk. I was also told that one of them wouldn't make it. And she told me she would do everything she could, and she did.
Now 19, twins Tamara and Tierra Kennedy were born 12 weeks early and underweight. One was medevac to CHOP.
One got better. She came home. The other one stayed in the hospital for almost a year.
Howard took the girls to day hospital, which was all day, Monday through Friday. When the girls were 8 months old, Dr. Hecker started the Reach Out and Read program.
She told me there was a big program where they can get books inside the doctor's office. And I'm like, books? They don't need little kids. But she used to tell me all the time, no matter how old they were, just keep reading books. And I would buy books, little books, and just read.
It's not just about a feel-good program.
Dr. Hecker says the program makes sense from a medical perspective.
It actually is changing brain growth. Neurons are developing at about 700 neural cells per second in those first 3 years of life. If they're not stimulated by us talking to our children, reading to them, engaging with them, those are pruned back.
Other doctors told Howard her daughters would likely struggle intellectually.
I had one doctor that told me that no matter what you did, your kid would probably be 50% to 80% the lead. And I'm like, no, that's not possible.
Tiara Kennedy says without their doctor always pushing them to read, her and her sister would probably be one of those preemie statistics.
If we didn't have her, I think we'd be like behind a little.
Her sister Tamara says the program played a big role as they grew.
I think it did have an impact because it improved vocabulary and writing out sentences and stuff like that.
Both girls attended magnet high schools, and this fall they headed off to college on academic scholarships. Research shows the program improves school outcomes. Howard says she probably wouldn't have read to the girls that early.
It got to a point where all they wanted to do was go to the doctor's office because they could get the books.
She says the program influenced her parenting, but it also helps communities without bookstores and serves some parents who may not have graduated high school.
This is a change, and it was one of the things that I really liked about the doctor's office. They were bringing change in a community that really needed it.
Dr. Hecker says one reason doctors are involved in pre-literacy is because they're a consistent voice in children's early years.
We see kids at many ages, so we get to know them very well. They look to us for trusted guidance on diet, nutrition, safety, development issues, and so this is absolutely a natural extension of that.
And the pediatrician is still handing out books.
Great. Hi, guys. Hi, Janaya. How are you? And there's Taylor. I have a book for each of you. Do you like books, Taylor? Look, Janaya, this is a new one. We just got this.
For WHYY News, I'm Sarah Hoover.
Philly sports fans, stop agonizing over the Eagles, Phillies, Flyers, and Sixers. Instead, take pride in being home to the second consecutive winner of Sports Illustrated's Sports Kid of the Year. Now, in 2014, the region and nation fell in love with honor roll student and Little League pitcher Monet Davis. You remember her, the first girl to pitch a shutout in the Little League World Series. And now, Penn Charter High School sophomore swimmer Reese Whitley graces the cover of the December issue of Sports Illustrated Kids. Reese, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations, and let's note you won the 200-meter breaststroke at the 2015 Speedo Junior National Championships, although I imagine that out of the 20,000 applicants for this award, there must have been other reasons why you were selected.
Oh, wow, 20,000. I actually didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Why were you tapped for this award?
You know, I think swimming is such a different sport. And I think that really contributed to, you know, me being selected for this award. You know, I think the fact that I excel at it a little bit helps out. But I think that also because I'm African-American, I think that's something else that, you know, happened to help out with me winning this award. I also do well in school. So I think those are all things that, you know, helped me win this award. And I do realize that, you know, there are plenty of other kids doing the same things that I'm doing inside and outside of their sport. So I understand that I'm very lucky.
Is this a pursuit that requires daily practice?
Yes. I'm in the water 6 days a week, totaling about, you know, 16 to 18 hours in the water by the end of the week. I'm in the weight room for an hour and 30 minutes 3 days a week. That's, you know, that's before school. And then I'll get in the water after school and practice on Saturday as well.
Never mind the athletic pursuit. How do you juggle that with school responsibilities at William Penn Charter?
Well, I think that at this point, balancing school and swimming comes pretty easily. You know, swimming teaches you at a young age that you need to manage your time very well if you want to be great both in the classroom and in the pool.
Any time left over for family, friends?
Oh, yeah,
hobbies?
There's always time. There's always time for family. You know, family's first with me. You know, not as much time for friends. I'm normally sleeping on the weekends if I'm not in the pool or, you know, just hanging out watching a movie or something like that. But, you know, I enjoy sleeping whenever I can, so.
You're a 15-year-old sophomore?
Yes, I am.
And your intent is to compete in the 2016 U.S. Olympic trials in June?
Yes, that's the.
Will you be the only 15-year-old competing?
Oh no, there are other 15-year-olds that will be competing. When I qualified, I qualified when I was 14, and I think that there were only four other 14-year-old males in the country who also qualified. One of them actually I grew up with. You know, he lives right around the corner from me, so it's pretty cool.
Always the breaststroke?
Always the breaststroke. I do, the way we train over here at Penn Charter, I do swim everything. And I'm also very close to making the 200-meter individual medley event for Olympic trials. So hopefully we can add that to the event lineup within the next couple of months. But yeah, mainly breaststroke at the high level. So,
is it safe to assume that you don't really have much competition in local meets?
Oh, no, that's definitely not safe to say. You know, there's always somebody who could, you know, pop out of nowhere and have a great race, you know, and, you know, I do have bad races frequently. So, you know, at local meets, it just depends on who's there. You know, in breaststroke, there's nobody really in the region who's my age who's really keeping close, but, you know, there are younger kids who are developing at, you know, much faster rates than I was, you know, at that age, so.
Did you, in turn, pop out of nowhere at one time and surprise more established swimmers?
I think I did. You know, I really was not the best swimmer growing up. You know, I think just years and, you know, hours of hard work and training just kind of got me to this point. You know, some swimmers are just kind of born with, you know, natural talent, and others really have to really grind to be successful and, you know, to be great in the sport. And I think I was one of those kids who really had to grind and, you know, work really hard, pay attention to my stroke technique a lot to get where I am today.
Well, congratulations. Thank you. You are the recipient of the 2015 Sports Kid of the Year. Reese Whitley joining us on Newsworks tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. The Sixers are swimming against the current this season. They put their season-starting 18-game losing streak to the test tonight, and win, lose, or draw, we'll talk about the team on tomorrow's show with longtime Sixers announcer Mark Zumoff. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The holiday gift that keeps on giving is a fund at the Philadelphia Foundation. You can support the arts, protect natural areas, promote health, provide scholarships, and help the needy, all while receiving tax benefits. The Foundation makes it easy to make a difference now and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Kent Jones talks about his new documentary, Hitchcock Truffaut, inspired by the interviews French director François Truffaut recorded with Alfred Hitchcock in 1962. And we hear from Niecy Nash, who co-stars as a nurse in HBO's Getting On, which is set in the extended care wing of a hospital. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
Arden Theater Company proudly supports WHYY and presents Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates, now playing through January 31st. This new production celebrates the importance of grit and determination, the value of generosity, and the thrill of flying down the ice on a pair of skates. Tickets and information at 215-922-1122 or ardentheater.org. Arden Theater supports WHYY.